Value Market is Louisville's grocer. Since 1978, Value Market has been your neighborhood grocery store for all of life's best moments. Value Market gets it. Life is busy. That's why Value Market has curbside and delivery since 2013, freeing up more of your time for the more important things in life. Kids' ball games, family visits, work, tailgating, and cookouts. Value Market gets it. That's why Value Market has four area locations to serve your grocery needs. Mid-City Mall, Outer Loop Plaza, Aircoy Manor, and Mount Washington. At Value Market, you got savings in the bag. ValueMarket.com.
Tired of jumping from job to job? How about a career in a recession-proof industry where you can make a difference and help create a healthier living and working environment? The pest management industry gives you the opportunity to work with more independence. OPC Pest Services will give you a chance to grow with advancement. Come be a part of our team at OPC Pest Services. Apply online at opcpest.com/careers. That's opcpest.com/careers.
Where do you go to find all your favorite wine, beer, and spirits with selections customized to local tastes? For over 25 years, that go-to place has been Cox's Spirit Shop. Cox's, Louisville's go-to liquor store.
It's time for the Roundtable with Round Daddy.
Hey, Round Daddy.
The Roundtable with Round Daddy.
Me, James Strebel, Big Daddy.
With your host, James Strebel.
Hey, Round Daddy, James Strebel. Gotcha.
On ESPN 680 and 105.7.
Now, you're not usually here on Weird Wednesdays.
I know.
Is this your first one?
No, not
your first one.
No, it's not my first one. I've done a handful.
Okay.
But, it kind of falls into... There's how Strebel treats you as his second chair compared to me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
I feel like
the ugly stepchild a little bit sometimes.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Because you get to go out to all the good remotes.
Well,
I don't go to all the good remotes.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if that's on purpose. You think it is?
Well, Diener said it was on purpose.
When I
complained about it, Diener texted in and said, yeah, you could do it in Max's neighborhood anytime you want. Oh. Welcome back to the Round Table with Round Daddy, Max Godby, and Anna Trillo in.
Yo,
Bro Strebel, chilling with Kirby Smart in New York.
Doing the things he does.
I think that's a great conversation. I would love to be a fly on a wall to see Strebel talk to Kirby Smart.
To interact with him.
With a few brewskis.
Kellen had the big guns. He went out there and talked his stuff. I'm proud of young Kellen Strebel.
He's networking.
He is.
He's networking.
He's making us proud is what he's doing.
Speaking of network, another person that is in my network that has gone on to bigger and better things is a dear friend, a great coach in Carter Barfield, who's currently the special teams analyst at Florida State. Very, very familiar with both the UK and Louisville programs. But, Carter, thank you so much for the time today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Man, first of all, you're all sports information director. Awesome guy. Awesome guy. But it's the first time it felt like I had to go through Fort Knox to be able to get a hold of you also. It was a list of questionnaires. It's like, I was like, man, I don't think you understand what type of show this is. Like, I'm not some hard-hitting gotcha question journalist, to say the least. But, man, I really appreciate the time.
Oh, no doubt. I'm excited.
So I want to talk to you because you've been a guy that's been involved with special teams since I've known you, and you've seen special teams evolve from the pro style punt formation to the integration into the three person shield in front of the punter to now a back probably 5-6 years ago, kind of a resurgence of the pro style punt, to now almost like a two-man shield punt system, and then not to mention how even from the blocking styles on kickoff and kick return and punt and for punt return as well, the game, just like on the offense and defensive side of the ball, special teams is changing as well. So I'd really love for you to kind of just talk about what you've seen over your past 10, 14, 16 years of coaching on how you've seen special teams change.
Well, it's changed in a bunch of different ways, from personnel. I mean, going to the actual specialists with the, you know, the influx of Australian punters to, kind of the change in the how specialists are coached coming into college. And but, you know, kind of start off with the punt scheme. You know, when it wasn't that long ago, I guess 20 years ago, where it was all pro style. Mm-hmm. And you had a snapper who had to protect, and you had – I mean, you had two gunners flexed out, and those were your guys that would go down there and make the play, and everyone else was just kind of in case they didn't. And I, you know, it was about 20 or so years ago where teams started figuring out that it's not – the rules aren't the same as the NFL. And a lot of people don't realize this, but in the NFL, only the gunners can run down. The end guys on line of scrimmage are able to cover before the ball is punted. And in college, anyone can cover before the ball is actually hit the foot of the punter. So the people realized, well, we can change the protection so that guys can get out faster and cover faster and limit the big plays in the punt return game. And so people went to this three-man shield where they figured they'd have three big O linemen that would create a shield, and then everyone else can just block for a second and release. And if anyone got through, they would have to deal with three 300-plus pound guys to get through to block the punt. And then from that, people kind of figured out what that scheme was, how to defeat it, just like anything, offense or defense. And then it kind of evolved into, well, we could do a two-man shield, and we can offset the punter, and we can get him where he's lined up over the guard or over the tackle even, and move the pocket, move the launch point, the block point, and still find ways to get guys out quick to cover, because that's the unique thing about punt is that there's a lot of bad things that can happen. You can get a punt blocked, or you can get a punt returned for a touchdown against you. So you got to find ways to protect and cover all within the same play.
So I'd like to stick with the shield and talking about the concept of the three offensive linemen. Or when I was playing, it was myself and two defensive ends that were lined up on it, and it was a great sales pitch by Craig Niver, who is the special teams coordinator at Kentucky at the time, that said, you know, only the meanest, toughest dudes are able to go into the shield. And he left out the part, the dumbest, because you've got to be a fool to volunteer for that role. So what do you look for when you find three guys in the shield, especially the guy that's that personal protector in the middle, where they are an extension of a quarterback almost?
Well, they are. They're the quarterback of the punt team. And, you know, 99%, if not 100% of all college football teams in America are going to spend way more time on punt team than any other special teams unit, because it has, like I said, the most things that can go wrong, and it has the most amount of yardage and field position that can be changed in a seven-second play. And so you have to find three guys that are, I guess, dumb enough to be able to sit there and be the final wall of defense with guys that are going to run full speed at you. But you also have to have that guy, the Max Godby, that can make the calls, you know, similar to a center or quarterback on offense. And you have to be able to communicate, not only know what the protection is, and where you're weak and where you're strong at, but you have to be able to communicate it well with all these other guys. And unlike offense, where the quarterback is for an hour and 45 minutes in practice, he's with the offense, and they work on the communication, and it's with other offensive guys. On punt, it might be an O-lineman in there making calls, and he has linebackers and safeties and running backs and whoever, including the snapper and the punter, on the same unit as you. So there's offense and defense together, and you got to be able to communicate in a way that everyone's able to understand it.
How much has the – when you look at punt return, to switch over to that side of the ball for a second,
mm-hmm.
I remember when I was playing, there was such a kind of a renaissance era of punt block and really having just a very aggressive mindset on the opposing punt team of going out and trying to solidify blocks, whether that was schemes with the four guys up the middle trying to confuse the shield, or put six guys inside the A gap and basically making them kind of just pick and choose where to go, or just to eat up some of the other headhunters that were going down there in those guard tackle positions on punt team. But you see a lot of safe punt where they keep the defense in, put the defense in, but again, really setting up for punt return, especially when the opposing team or that punt team is backed up into their own end zone and really not taking a chance. Is there anything from just a stats or data analysis that suggests that you need to go with a punt return? Do you've got better results for that?
Well, there are some stats, and the numbers kind of vary year to year, but the you know, people will say that you win X amount of games if you block a punt, but that's not the whole story, because sometimes people are rushing the punter. Like, if you're up by 30, you're probably not trying to block punts. So the other team might be trying to block a punt. So that can skew things a little bit to where it's not all the same. But when it comes to returns, like talking about being backed up, and you always have to be worried about the backed up teams coming after you, because especially if you're inside the 5-yard line, it's a shorter distance for the punter than normal. But to me, it's not always the same, but if you block a punt backed up, the odds are strong that ball will get blocked back into out the back of the end zone for 2 points. And you get 2 points, which is great, and you get the ball back and all that stuff. But you could also really set yourself up to score 7 points by giving the illusion of blocking a punt, but actually getting a good return. They're going to have a quick punt on, which means it's going to be probably a quicker operation, a lower punt, lower hang time. Their gunners aren't going to get down there as fast, and you're going to have a chance to return it with some space to get 10, 20 yards, you know, hopefully minimum, and set yourself up deep inside your opponent's territory to score a touchdown as opposed to just getting 2 points.
You kind of brought it up a little bit briefly there, but just I'm curious, how much you rely on analytics? How much has that changed in the past, like, 5 years? And how much of it, for you, does it really come down to, like, making these in-game decisions? Or does that make sense what I'm asking? Or how much you're just relying on the analytics, like the pure statistical data of when to do what?
So a lot of that's actually, you know, outsourced. A lot of teams, and this is in the NFL and college, probably even high school at this point, where you subscribe to these analytics companies, and they break it down for you, and then it's up to the coach, the head coach, to use it as much or as little as he wants to. And I've been at different programs that will use the quote unquote the book more than others, and it'll say everything from when to punt, when to kick a field goal, when to go for it. And then, you know, down to end of game scenarios and all of those things. And most teams will have someone kind of dedicated to that, to kind of be giving the in-game giving the in-game information to the head coach. Mm. And then he has to make that decision. And just like anything, it's a tool. It's not, you don't live by it, but you use it as part of the information that goes into your decision making.
All right,
that's a great answer.
I've got to distract just for a second, because you talked about analytics and the freedom of a coach to either choose it or not, to use it or not use it. You were there with Randy Sanders, who was my offensive coordinator, our offensive coordinator when we were both at UK, and
absolutely,
of course, that was the year that he was coaching Jameis Winston. That's when won national championship, won a Heisman. I mean, Randy is a quarterback whisperer with everywhere he's gone, Kentucky, Tennessee, Florida State. But I've got to ask, especially when analytics were starting to get really big a few years ago, how much did Randy take into account of that? Was he reluctant, or was he buying into it?
Well, it probably wasn't as big when he was at Florida State.
Okay.
And then when he went on to East Tennessee State, just knowing Randy and you knowing him too, I would say he I would say he would probably use it more than people would think, because he is a very, very analytical guy. But I remember just from our conversations when I was at Kentucky, during games, after games, he's very much analyzes the in-game scenarios. I think most offensive coordinators and special teams coordinators love that stuff. Love the kind of game within the game, the scenarios, all of those things. And I mean, really, it takes, I mean, most coaches, I think, pride themselves on intelligence, and it takes a good amount of intelligence to kind of think through those things.
Absolutely. And Coach Sanders is he's a savant when it comes to offensive schemes. But I want to bring this up as well, because not a lot of fans realize this, because when special teams is going in disarray or special teams is having a bad year, the instant thought is, well, the special teams coordinator's got to suck. Like, he's not any good. But what a lot of people don't know is a lot of programs – it's special teams by committee, with having a coach lead a certain part of that special teams. Can you kind of delve in, not giving into any Florida State stuff, but maybe your time at Georgia Southern or Mercer or Kentucky, kind of delve into that and kind of giving fans an inside look?
Yeah, so I've definitely been at different places that do it different ways. I've been a part of programs where they split up. Everyone's got their own unit. It was like that at Mercer. I was in charge of the punt team. And then at Georgia Southern, it was split up by unit. And Florida State, Coach John Papuch, just our special teams coordinator, he coordinates it all. But every coach is involved in it. And I think back to even when we were at Kentucky, we had a GA who was, his job was, he was coaching the left end on punt. And he was a receiver's GA, and that was his job. You know, you take ownership in it and you coach it like it's a position, like you're coaching an offensive or defensive position. In my opinion, the good, and I'm obviously biased in this, but the good coaches know the value of special teams, and you have to find a way to, whether it's by committee or whether it's with one coordinator, but you have to find a way to motivate the coaches and the players to take it seriously. And that's easier said than done a lot of times, and I've been at places where it's done different ways. Fortunately, I'm at a place right now where it's a high priority put on by the head coach, and so the coaches and the players are pretty bought in on it.
That's a great point. I just had one question real quick. So Jay Boulware, he does Kentucky special teams now, and I think I interviewed him when he first got to Kentucky. It came from the Steelers, I believe. So he talked about that was one of the things when he was with the Steelers he kind of mentioned that he was shocked at how little prepared a lot of these guys were coming from college to play special teams in the NFL. And that's something that he wanted to bring to Kentucky, just a more professional approach to it. Why do you think that is? Why is it, because it's kind of divvied up differently among the different, different college teams of who's in charge of what? Or why is there appear to be some kind of drop off between the two levels?
I think a lot of that has to do with there's certain programs that don't want to put their quote-unquote best players on special teams.
Yeah.
And so your quote-unquote best players are the ones that inevitably go on to the NFL. And if they haven't been doing special teams because they are protected in college, then they get to the NFL and they don't know how to block a punt or protect or cover on kickoff or any of those things, and they're having to learn it. And so you see – once again, you see that the best teams use the best players, and you have to be smart with it at times. But I can remember being when I was coaching the punt at Mercer, and we played Alabama in 2017, and they had all four of those running backs, Damian Harris and Najee and Bo Scarborough, and there was four of them, and they were all on their punt return team. All four of them were. So like they. You find ways to get your best players to one, help you win games on special teams, and two, you prepare them for the NFL.
One last question, then we'll let you go, Carter, is you brought up the head coach you're currently working for right now with Mike Norvell and the amazing job Florida State did last year on a a great season. And I just not give delving in too much, but his ability to be able to, with a very disappointing outcome when it comes to the college football playoff, not getting in, even though you had an undefeated record, going into this season, how's been the mentality? I mean, Florida State is still extremely looked as a contender for a national championship this year by the media, and by all speculation is basically just reloaded at this point. What can you kind of talk about the coaching job of Coach Norvell on how he's been able to motivate those players to be able to not lose sight?
Well, I've heard it said that your team takes on the mentality of their coach, and that's been him from the beginning. He is whatever he wants is what he does. So toughness, hard work, improving every day, all of those things, it's not just buzzwords that you put on slogans on a wall in your team room. Like, he lives it every day. And every time you talk to one of our players, like, they can say what they want about Coach Norvell and the times when he's getting mad at you or getting on to you or all those things, but he is consistent. And that's, to me, that's how you, if you want to build a consistent program, you have to have a consistent head coach. And his leadership is, I mean, I've never been around a football coach like him. His leadership with his, I know I'm supposed to say this because I work for him, but it's true. But his leadership through consistency is incredible. He motivates others to want to be consistent. And when he calls you out on your inconsistency, you have nothing to say because of his consistency and everything he does. And it's created an attitude in our team where hard work, discipline, daily improvement, all of those things that are slogans on team rooms across the country are actually being lived by our team.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Carter, you did a fantastic job, man. I really appreciate you coming on, spending some time with us, and best of luck this season, man.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
Awesome. That's Carter Barfield, special teams analyst for Florida State, and awesome guy. I mean, just a genuinely good guy. It was funny. There was a texter that texted in like as soon as Carter started talking.
Yeah.
And it just says, "I hate that man." And I was like, "How can you hate Carter?
You don't even know him."
He's like, "Carter's a good guy." And then it had something to do with Locke and what he said earlier. I was like, "Oh, okay."
I was going to guess Kirby Smart or something.
I was like, "Okay, that makes a little bit more sense."
You were like, "Ready to defend him?" You were getting the Twitter fingers out. You're like, "I will come right at you on that."
Carter's a good guy.
Carter's nice.
No,
man, that was so insightful. And I just want to give a shout out to Max for killing it with the guests these week. They've all been so good and so insightful.
Well, when you don't speak well and you don't have a lot to say, you just get your friends
you
that know a
do.
Lot more than
you do.
You do
a good job of both.
Well, I appreciate
but that
it.
Was really that was really interesting. And I think that's a thing that special teams is a thing that a lot of people are curious about. A lot of people have complaints about it. It changes the outcome of games, but we don't talk about it necessarily. We don't get that kind of insight enough.
Exactly.
You know? And it is interesting how it's such an important part of the game and it's still kind of a by committee thing. That's wild.
It wasn't until I got onto special teams and I was on punt and field goal, mm-hmm. Especially when I got into punt, it was an eye opener to me of just how critical it is and how in depth it is. It isn't just kick the ball and run down the field. There is a lot to it. The playbook it's not as thick as an offensive playbook, but still a pretty thick playbook
really?
As well.
Interesting.
Got a few texts here. I said we get to the ones from earlier.
Yeah. Good job, texters.
The Stoops goof off the bye week. Yeah, that's typically when it happens.
Cease and desist.
Do we need a chance taker at coach to go to the next level? I think, first of all, I am in no way, shape, or form saying that Stoops needs to leave. Like, I'm not saying that because I still think it has more to do with just a philosophical change at offense, and I think a lot changes if he does that. But I think whether Stoops leaves or Stoops retires, I think the mentality that you have to go it's just like what you do with a coach you've had for a very long time. Alabama's a great example. Is you go with someone who is the opposite of what you used to have. So I think Kentucky needed a Stoops that was like toast, Wonder Bread. Just, it, that, and I'm not saying that as an insult. I'm saying it as someone that's going to be consistent.
For sure.
And someone that's
old
going
school.
To, yes, provide that steady. And also a guy that wasn't going to leave within the first 3-4 years mm-hmm. either. I think that was going to be beneficial. But I think whenever Coach Stoops moves on, whether that's to another school or decides to retire, I think you do need to have that. You need to have that one. You need to have a chance taker, someone that's going to mm-hmm. be like a Lane Kiffin almost, that's willing to roll the dice. To me, if we were playing in this fantasy land, it would be John Sumrall or Neil Brown.
Yeah.
Those would be the two that I say those are the first two people you
think
talk
Neil
to.
Is more of a chance taker?
He can be.
Yeah.
He can be. But the thing is, he was a lot more this year. Again, he was on the hot seat.
And it paid off.
Yes. And he was on the hot seat at West Virginia. I put that.
It was like deja vu.
It was with a grain of salt because of he was left such a bad program.
Yeah.
Like, people do not understand, especially with the people I know that were at West Virginia with uh-huh. Neil Brown, that, I mean, there was nothing. The cupboards were bare
yeah.
when he got there. So I those would be the two, because I think they would be guys that would be will at least mm-hmm. from an offensive standpoint push the edge.
And I feel like we've seen that in the offensive coordinators that Stoops has hired, is like he's trying to do that, trying to modernize with that and like change the aspect of his philosophy in that way. But it's like, can he be hands off about it and let them do them and have that, you know, risk taking thing? And I think when Liam Cohen was there in the first year, we did see the benefits
yes.
of that a bit. But you know how much of that was Will Levis being a quarterback.
Exactly. And I think the big thing that happened last year was just you just didn't know how to use Devin Leary.
Which is crazy.
You
recruited him and had all the film.
You had the directions for a flathead screwdriver and you had a Phillips screwdriver.
I will never understand. I need a behind the music on that one.
Texter, UK football will lose at Texas. I already read that. I'm sorry. But it's still funny. He texted it twice, or I think it just came in. It came in twice, but it's funny. JMU shout out. Let's go.
Yeah, boy.
This is about Locke. It's funny, but I'm not going to read that. We all know Rig pulls his punches with Anna, but if I'm marketing a company at a remote, I'm not taking Max when Anna is available.
I mean, I don't know what to thank you. I don't know what to say to that. That's funny. But also, you know, sometimes, I don't know.
I look like a Neanderthal, which is fine. It's fine.
That's not true.
I look like a freak, especially with Strebel.
He's lying.
Strebel looks like a freak. I look like
you look
a freak.
Like you're in there to be like bouncers. You're like, can I apply for the nightclub
security?
Nephilim.
Like, we look like Nephilim.
You're
just
like,
giants.
Where do I apply to be a bouncer?
Dude, when we did the little putt-putt contest at the liquor barn, like, yeah. people were scared. We just walk over. I go putt now.
Who invited the caveman? What's going on?
All right. When we come back, we are going to do Weird Wednesday.
Yes.
We're just moving to 4:30.
I'm so pumped.
We're going to be talking about the Tartarian Empire Ooh. And the mud floods, and it has a little bit of a City of Louisville twist to it.
Let's go.
You're listening to the Roundtable on ESPN 680.
Taking care of your family isn't always easy, so we make sure getting care when you need it is. With Baptist Health Urgent and Virtual Care, we bring you more options and greater convenience, too. With video visits available 24/7 and online check-in through MyChart for in-person visits. To check in online or to set up a video visit, go to baptisthealth.com/careanywhere.
When it's time to replace your heating and air system, we know people want options. That's why you'll always get a free second opinion with BJ Heating and Cooling. Plus, for a limited time, get 0% financing for 60 months on a new Bryant system.
Call the experts you can trust at BJ Heating and Cooling.
Aina's not here yet. She got pulled over.
Oh, yeah.
So we that's why Aina's not here, but she'll be here.
Welcome back to the Roundtable with Round Daddy. Now here's Round Daddy, James Strebel.
That's great.
I love that. every time I'm late here now, people are like, oh, God, Anna's arrested. Anna's in the back of a cruiser right now because she was mean to an officer.
Not going to lie, when you said that you were you may be running late, I thought,
you're like, oh, shoot.
She may have just got pulled over.
She in the jail.
It's a round table with Round Daddy. Strebel, obviously, in New York. Max Godby and Anna Tarillo in. Just because Strebel is out, that does not mean that there is no Weird Wednesday.
We get weird.
And thank you to the texter. I got my conspiracy theories mixed up. Because it's Tartarian Empire and then Mudbloods. That's a completely different one. I was trying to find something that I was not super familiar with.
So I love that.
This one, actually, Ash brought to me.
I
was like, it's very cool. It's not like the standard stuff that Strebel says where he's like, he's all in on.
Yeah.
This one, I'm like, maybe.
Food for thought.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's... That's a great way of putting it. Food for thought, make you ponder a little bit.
I love that you and Ash can, like, go toe-to-toe on this and talk about it. Because, like, some people, if you try to talk about it with people in your life, they're like, what are you talking about? Are you crazy? But it's kind of cool, though, that y'all talk about it. I think that's good.
I've always been one, and she's the same. It's you don't just take everything with a grain of salt.
No.
And sometimes, if you question it, you look at it, you look at the data, you're like, okay, this... Yeah, this checks out. But then if you question it, all of a sudden things don't line up. And then you're like, oh, wait a second. And then you go down.
I'm new to that mindset. Yeah. But it's been eye-opening.
All right. Well, hey, Tanner, let's play the sound and let's get into Weird Wednesday.
Conspiracies. Extraterrestrials. The occult. Gather around the lunch table, children. Don't try to get up. He won't let you leave. It's Weird Wednesday with Mr. Strebel.
God,
great edit there, Tanner. Great edit. All right, so.
That was funny.
Food for thought anytime you are reading conspiracy. And this is why I gave this one a little bit more legs. Because usually when you hear a conspiracy theory, you hear any sort of theory, and it's instantly hit with data to argue it, that's when you know, okay, this doesn't have legs.
Really?
However, if the first thing is an insult to that theory when there's no data to be presented, that to me starts going, okay, I'm going to delve into this a little bit. Like, if someone says, you know, Max didn't play football at UK, or he's like, he actually played at EKU.
Yeah.
And you go, well, no, he did. Here's all the pictures of him at UK, like, here's all the data for it. But then the first thing goes, I can't believe you would say that. It destroyed the integrity of UK. No, of course he played at UK. You're just stupid for believing that.
Yeah.
When you have that type of an attack on anyone that questions something, at that point you're like, either they don't know what they're talking about, or no one knows what they're talking about. So this was one, when I first read it, I was like, I don't think this has legs. But then, started reading it a little bit more, and once I saw, like, all the rebuttals, it's like, bizarre conspiracy theory, or it's stupid, and it's like, but there was no data to back it.
Why are you trying so hard to put it down?
All right, so, this is an article from Bloomberg that kind of goes in. So, the Tartarian Empire, so, the premise behind this is an ancient empire, hundreds of years, thousands of years before humans were even on the earth, that were actually an advanced set of humans or advanced set of interstellar beings, aliens, whatever it is. So think of it like this. A lot of this started developing after the burning of Notre Dame in Paris, of this idea of look at all these beautiful buildings, that you see in, like, Moscow or the state capital in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Some of the historic buildings that we have here in Louisville that are just gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous, with marble, the attention, the detail on it. They look fantastic. But we don't see that anymore. You don't see that. You don't see that style anymore. Not only do you not see that style anymore, you never see anything close to the same quality either.
Yeah.
So that's red flag number one. And then there's the red flag number two, where a lot of these are now starting to be, these type of buildings are now starting to be either demolished or built over, saying that there's a possible kind of washing away of these old buildings to embrace modernism. So the conspiracy theory then instantly breaks in of this is a QAnon experience, conspiracy to reject modernism. That's what it is. But this is a true conspiracy theory against the history of architecture itself. Mm-hmm. So, in 1908, Ernest Flaggs completed the single building in Lower Manhattan, a Beaux Arts showstopper made for Singer Sewing Machine Company. From a wide base, a slender 27-story tower rose, topped by a mansard roof and a delicate lantern spire. Every inch was sumptuous detail inside and out. It was celestially radiant. A book that was written about its construction is from what it was from. For a year, it was the tallest building in the world at 612 feet and celebrated landmark for decades after that. But not too much longer, despite its great height, the pencil-thin tower lacked office spaces. In the 1960s, the company sold its ornate headquarters. Demolition proceeded in 1967, tallest building to ever be peacefully demolished. By any account, it's a fantastical tale. Once the tallest building in the world and a New York icon knocked down in just a handful of decades. For some, fantastical to believe. Perhaps not fantastical at all. A dedicated group of YouTubers and Reddit posters see the Singer Building and countless other discarded pre-modern beauties and extant Beaux Arts landmarks as artifacts of a globe-spanning civilization called the Tartarian Empire, which was somehow erased from the history books. Adherents of this theory believe these buildings to be the keys to a hidden past, clandestinely obscured by malevolent actors. Who? Why? To what possible end? As in many others, more high-profile conspiracy theories, this Baroque fantasy, again, the Bloomberg's going to obviously say it's stupid.
of course.
But it's grounded in some real anxieties, pointing towards the changes wrought by the modern world in general and modern architects specifically, and rejecting both. So buildings like this, and this is where it started getting legs when Notre Dame was burnt, of this idea of these accidents that were happening, of these historical buildings, these eloquent buildings. So the Tartarian themed content is produced by YouTube videos that get picked over on Reddit. Really started gaining traction in December of 2018. The Tartarian theory, which appears to have first emerged in 2016-2017. The Tartarian storyline is not directly related to adrenochrome harvesting satanic pedophile cabal that lies at the heart of QAnon, okay? but the overall premise is an alternative history. A vast technology advanced Tartarian empire emanating from North Central Asia, thereabouts, either influenced or built vast cities and infrastructures all over the world. Tartaria or Tartary, though never a coherent empire, was indeed in a general term for North Central Asia. Either via a sudden cataclysm or a ready anachronistic decline, gosh, I can't talk, perhaps as recently as 100 years ago, Tartaria fell. Its great buildings were buried and its history was erased. After this great reset, the few surviving examples of Tartarian agriculture or architecture were falsely recast as the work of contemporary builders who could never have executed buildings of such grace, beauty, and subjected them to clumsy alterations.
Huh.
I think this was one worldwide civilization. Joachim Skaar, a 26-year-old Norwegian who runs the Tartarian Meltdown YouTube channel. It was all based on unity, oneness, peace, love, and harmony, which we don't see in today's society. There's an arch traditionalism present in the theory, too. The pre-modern buildings that we venerate are sometimes said to be more than 1,000 years old. The same people that built the Capitol in Washington, D.C. built the pyramids in Egypt is basically the premise. So all these features that you see from the pyramids to U.S. Capitol, not the White House, but Capitol buildings throughout, those were left standing
yeah.
for those were left standing for the humans in this different history. So it's very interesting to where you've got a mixture of, it could be that it's just a wormhole issue where it's a different reality and our realities are
coinciding.
Yeah, coinciding with each other.
Like different dimensions.
Or even the concept, it also goes into where it also goes into the Mandela effect as well, on how so many people hear different things or grew up with different aspects. Mm-hmm. And that's a idea of us possibly, our minds are in alternate realities as well. It's like deja vu. Yes. So it's very interesting. And the reason I found it interesting, I thought it would be good today, is because of the buildings here in Louisville, where the Louisville is this guy that does the Tartarian meltdown, has referenced Louisville's
old Louisville.
Yes,
because it's like the highest number of like Victorian homes is in the United States, or it's like second behind some other place
that I'm not 100%
in the United
sure.
States. But it is definitely on the map, and it's just strange how I feel like they're not like respected in that way. Okay, I have a couple questions. Well, just number one, a comment. They do say that a lot of this ancient architecture, well, I know the pyramids is one of them, and even like the Florence, like the Duomo, I believe, in Florence, like we no longer have the technology, they say, to create buildings like this anymore. They ask architects, so like, why don't we build this today? Number one, I think it used to be like a life's mission, even with these houses in Old Louisville. I've done tours and stuff there, ghost tours, but they talk about that with these houses. It would be one man or one family's an architect to build. His life's work was this one house, and it would take decades. And like, to each detail in the balustrade and everything, each little tiny detail. We don't do that anymore, right? Or even like the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona in Spain. It's like over 100 years still being constructed. Like, you just don't see it anymore. So I think maybe the technology could be lost that way. But even like geometrically and stuff, with the I think the Parthenon is one, or the Pantheon is one. Mm-hmm. And like the pyramids, it's like when they say we don't have the technology anymore, I think even in Machu Picchu as well, and other places around the world, they look at how the stones were configured together in ways way before there was anything modern, that it looked like it'd be cut by laser. It's like, okay, like, how did they put that together, you know? So my question is for these people. So was it saying like buildings like the Capitol and stuff, that was just already there?
It was already there.
Okay. I was thinking maybe like it was like still this like sect of people on Earth who were like still having these things built, but they think it was already there. Okay.
So
interesting.
Basically, and premise of it is like, you see everything involving in movies or not ancient, but history books of like when the colonies were first coming in, and you looked at all the buildings it was all pioneer style houses,
like log cabins,
exactly, sticks, cut lumber, exactly,
yeah.
and then all of a sudden a magnificent Capitol building as well.
When did they say that was built, the Capitol building?
That's
like before
question.
The White House and everything, like they say it was like before that.
I don't know.
Because I know there's like documentation on like how like slaves built the White House, like enslaved people. And so like, I think people were trying to like, you know, like.
The Capitol was built in September
18, 1793. Okay. I'm interested because I feel like that is something like, if that like were the case, it wouldn't be that hard to just not include that in history books. Or like, I feel like at that time of the country, it's not the same now as social media, or even with the breadth of like literacy and stuff now, like it wouldn't be so hard to contain, you know, that
right.
it wouldn't be some big secret that if it were already there.
So in one thing as well, in the article, it goes back to what I talk about. So like in the article, you could tell it's like, well, it's just a branch off of the QAnon conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Or it's a they go and do a basically hit piece on the guy that runs that Skarl. Mm-hmm. who's Norwegian, who's a plumber, and they said he's not a architect or historian, but he claims that both are wrong.
Yeah.
Which it's like, that's the data that's being presented as the counter argument.
Yeah.
And so anytime, and again, this is doing 3 days worth of research on this. So bear with
Heart
me
in
on
the paint.
It. But it's a, it was enough where it's like, okay, if it's so easy to disprove, then just show the date, like just show data on where, like documentation of when the Capitol was built, or like there had to be some sort of law, like some sort of like log or something
that
to be able to keep track of it. Not just saying, well, he's a plumber, so he's stupid.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So that aspect.
I feel like that's a type of philosophical debate. Gosh, my freshman year of college, I took like a philosophy course, and there's a term for that argument. I can't remember what it is, but it's like when you just like an ad hominem attack, like, oh, he's stupid, don't listen to him. You know, like there's a term for it in modern philosophy debate.
It's a not a straw man.
Yeah, straw man.
Is it straw man?
Yes, straw man. That's what I was.
Okay.
That's what I was thinking. That's exactly what it is.
I thought it could also fall within gaslighting. Also, so
sure.
You're just dumb.
Yeah, don't listen to him. Nothing to see here.
Exactly. He's fine. It's like, he's fine. He's fine. Oh gosh. So, texter. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and read it. Hang pulls sound like something after Hawk Tua.
Good Lord.
Okay.
Good Lord.
Strebel has fallen to the trap of these Hawk Tua jokes, and I was like, I'm just going to go ahead and read it.
Hey, sometimes you got to.
Texter. Rad. Thanks.
Yeah, boy.
He was saying to never never play that What a Pro Wants commercial again.
Oh God, I hate that. That's the worst thing on this earth. Talk to us.
Because you said that's the worst thing on earth.
Oh.
It's related to Chet Holmgren. You guys saw the quote that came up, it was from like earlier in the season. It was Chet taking note of Kate, because Biscuit just tweeted about it. Chet taking note of KD shooting 54% from beyond the arc this season. I just want you to hear this and just be like, hey, what were those words? Because this is what I said. And I'm like the same age as him. 54 from Trey Ball is OD shooting hang poles. What?
I cannot.
54 from Trey Ball is OD shooting hang poles.
If a live living person came up to my face and said that to me,
I would think they're having a stroke.
I would too. I think it was Joe Biden was in here saying it. No, are you having, like, are you in reality? We got to get this man medical help. What?
It is somehow worse than the.
Listen, this is how I know I'm old. Like, this is how I know I'm old. Like, hearing things like that and then seeing the new, can't remember his name, with the Sixers, the guy who got drafted who's doing all the TikToks. I'm like,
McCann.
I'm not mad at it. I don't feel like, I'm not like, why is he doing that? Trying to chase him off my lawn with a cane. But I'm just like, I don't get it. Like, I don't get the entertainment value of it. Maybe I think I'm just old.
Well,
dude.
That's
just like the dances. I'm like, I don't get why people like this.
I saw a girl
like to watch it.
I went to Chick-fil-A yesterday, and before I came over here, and there was a girl that set her phone right by the on the ground.
Are you not embarrassed?
Up against the door, and then walked over and started doing a dance.
No,
and I was just like, why?
Have you seen the things where like a guy goes to Target and like brings his tripod? You could not catch me. If I were like under punishment for like a horrible crime, that's the only way you could get me to do that. Like, and I was in TV, so it's not like I'm like embarrassed to be seen on camera. It's the fact that it's so embarrassing to like drag your tripod around for your Target trip. Like, be a little less self-important, please. Like, I can't handle it.
Please.
Like, you're just giving yourself more stress and time.
Please join me in a day in the life of someone that goes to Target.
What? We've all been to Target.
What I hate.
The beginning of the videos where they get out of bed.
Yeah.
Set up the camera.
It's like me staying up with a baby who won't sleep. It's like, and you're making a video, so you're not even sleeping when you could. I can't stand it because it's inauthentic. Like, if you had a cameraman follow you around, okay, it's different. But don't set up your own stuff and tell me it's real.
Exactly. So,
treat it.
That, and then also the videos where it's so obvious, like when they walk up to someone and go, excuse me, sir. And I hate to put her on the spot, but my wife got on one of these.
Oh, she did?
She did.
Oh,
and
no. I don't believe it.
She walks, this girl walks up to this woman And she goes, excuse me, ma'am, I just wanted to ask, you just seem to just have a great soul and just want to know, it's like, what do you do? And it goes, oh, conveniently, I have a farm where I give away free food for everyone. Okay. Can I come see this farm? Oh, of course. And then they show up, and then the girl that handles, like, everything, like, all the gardening, like, she's out in the field gardening, in the process of gardening everything.
Yeah.
One, don't know if you garden. You usually have dirt on you in some way, shape, or form.
Yep. Got two, some calluses, everything.
Two, you're sweaty. Three, you don't look great doing. This girl was wearing a white shirt, white jeans, not any dirt on her whatsoever. Just fresh makeup.
Yeah.
And not a bead of sweat on her. And she goes, oh, I didn't know you all were going to be here. And it's a great story, and it's a great thing that they're doing, but it's like, come on now.
You can't even appreciate it because you were lying to me to set it up.
You lied to me. Therefore, I'm not going to do anything to help your organization.
I'm not going to be convinced because what else are you lying about?
But it's just like the person that goes, how much rent? How much do you pay for rent in New York? It's like, first of all, what sane person that's living in New York allows someone to come up to them with a phone in their hand, right in your face, and go, can I see where you live?
Those ones make me so angry. A, New York, it's just not like that. I love that about when I lived in New York. It's like nobody's unkind. They're just busy. They got somewhere to be. Just like, don't come up to me with some BS. Come up to me if you have a real question. I'll help you with directions, whatever. The second is, if somebody on the street right now is like, let me come see where you live, I'm like, A, you're going to murder me. Don't love that. B, I don't, like, who else, who just has everything perfectly beautiful and normal? I'm like, what if I left a sock out on the floor? Like, you just don't know. That, like, just why lie? Just set it up. Just, you know, we plan this in advance. It makes it more palatable, and it makes it more believable and honest, and I'd watch it again. But the fact you're lying.
I hate the videos where it's like, hey, excuse me, sir, how much do you make in a month?
And oh, yeah.
Then it's like,
and they have their girlfriend right there.
I don't feel openly like, okay with the answering that, but then they're like, oh, yeah, $30,000 a month. Oh, yeah. Wow, let me see your apartment. Sure, stranger. Yeah.
Right?
Man. That's real.
What do you do for a living? I was the first man to ever come up with a concept of a crypto behind a crypto and betting it under horses. What? Really? You were?
Just on a street corner here? I can't believe it. That's wild.
What are the odds of that?
Oh, I hate that.
Let's go into your super real apartment.
Yes.
And
totally
not a sample that we have ready to go.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's not been professionally cleaned and interior designed.
The whole concept during the Roman Empire, when things were getting really bad and everything was in disarray, it was like, I can't buy food. I'm poor. This government doesn't care about me. They care about expanding this empire. Huh. I hate all of this. What the Roman Empire did and what the Senate and Caesar did was distraction, which was create a carnival, which was the whole thing of building doing the Colosseum and having these events inside the Colosseum.
That's
where you get people
culture.
So distracted. Exactly.
Do you know that that's the highest paid people in our culture? It's not doctors. It's not, you know, any teachers, of course. It's not. It's entertainment. It's movie stars, singers, basketball, you know, football. Athletes.
It was people that trained the lions in the Colosseum, the gladiators. You know, the gladiators were quote unquote slaves, but they lived great.
They had advertising back then. Did you know they like literally had billboards, like in an NIL type of fashion?
Yeah.
And it's so absurd to us now thinking they had that then that they won't even put that in like movies about gladiators because like no one would believe this, even though it was true.
Exactly.
Like, it's the same thing happening. Like, it's crazy. It just, that just shocks me. We value entertainment more than anything else.
It's not like, it's not relatable at all where you're able to just go, you know, they just got done over a great weekend in the great weekend in the Colosseum. They show up to work at whatever they did in the Roman Empire and goes, man, did you see Maximus and Deloradius and their gladiator fight? And Oh, I know. Did you see where Maximus just straight up just decapitated Deloradius?
Yep,
so,
it.
Bro, that was just unreal. I mean, that's got to be the fight of the century. It's like there's nowhere else in history do we ever focus on big events like that and talk about it for a full week or have a radio show about it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we're part of the problem.
Are we the baddies?
We are. Just looked in the mirror on that one.
When we come back, we've got a few texts that I want to get into, and we'll go ahead and do the cleanup hour a little bit here on the Roundtable. You've been listening to the Roundtable on ESPN 680.